The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, throughout the year, we've talked about the bond market. We've talked about long bonds, short bonds, in between 7 to 10 year bonds. We're coming into December right now. Is there anything that we need to know about that market since it's so critical to understanding the rest of the economy?
Well, exactly. Kevin, this year we've looked at bills, bonds, and notes, all of the different ways that the government can finance its debt paper. And here's what's interesting, Kevin. We've seen short-term treasuries actually go negative in terms of their yield this year. We've seen the long-term bond head higher in terms of its yield and lower in price. And just as a reminder, about a year ago, we started talking about the bond market rolling over and this being a significant inflection point. At one point, we even said, if you look at the chart of the NASDAQ in 1999 and see this parabolic move up, that's what we were seeing last fall and winter in the bond market. And in fact, we did. We saw the 30-year treasury top out at about 137. Now, it fell from 137 to 112, which was a significant move. The yield was 2.75. It's recovered to over 4.35.
Okay, just to recap for people who don't understand the bond market, the higher the price, the lower the interest rate. The lower the interest rate, the higher the price. And it's a contrary motion. The price of the bond reflects a low yield. Is that correct?
And I think there's some other things that need to be noted in the context of these changes in the bond market. We've seen the two, most recently, in the last 3-4 weeks, we've seen the 2-year treasury and the 10-year treasury. The difference in yield between those two is incredibly huge. From a historic standpoint, you'd have to go back to the 1980s to see a spread like this.
And what does that signal?
Well, one of two things. Either there's inflationary expectations entering the bond market, or that there's default expectations entering the bond market.
So what you're saying is the person who's taking the long-term risk, who's going out and buying a 30-year bond, they're saying, I need more interest on that because I think there's going to be inflation.
And it's even showing up in the 10-year treasury, which isn't even that long-term compared to the 30. But that spread differential between the 2 and the 10 is telling you that one of those two things the bond market is becoming more concerned with, which we do not know. Is it inflation? Is 2010, 2011 a period of radical inflation? Or is 2010, 2011 a period of radical default wherein we see massive bank failures, continued deleveraging in the marketplace, and what we've talked about the last few weeks, a higher likelihood of downgrades on sovereign debt and even defaults.
Which is what Moody's was talking about, possibly going from AAA rating to AA rating on U.S. Treasuries.
Now, I think it's worth bringing into perspective that 2010 represents a very unique year for the United States. Not only will we add close to $2 trillion to our national debt, but we also have close to $2 trillion, which is coming due and needs to be refinanced. So we have in mass a block of $4 trillion in financing needs in U.S. government paper.
So we can't just look at the budget deficit and say that's it. We're talking about something that has to roll over or renew that's equal to what the deficit will be.
That's exactly right. So $4 trillion in funding needs in an environment where for the first time in decades, we have net selling of treasuries by our foreign creditors instead of net purchasing. So there is more liquidations happening of treasuries. In other words, the appetite for treasuries is going away or diminishing. At the same time, we need it to double, if not triple or quadruple in size. So we have this strange issue coming up in the interest rate market, in the bond market, which I think puts center stage this transition in the long-term bond arena and the long-term financing mechanisms for corporations and, of course, the U.S. government. So do we see interest rates heading higher? The grand theme in 2010, and we'll explore this in early January, is who will be in charge? Will it be the unseen hand of the market moving rates higher, or will it be the seen hand of government orchestrating and manipulating bond prices higher and interest rates lower to accommodate a still anemic economy? And so who ultimately wins in the battle between the seen hand and the unseen hand?
Well, the thing we've seen about manipulation all through the years, David, is that the seen hand can have an effect short term on almost anything because they have public funds. But they can't affect the long-term trend. They tried it with gold. They've tried it with interest rates. I mean, can they really affect the long-term trend of, say, the long bond?
In the short run, they can. In the long run, they cannot. And so one of the things we wanted to do is look back to that May program titled The Big Bomb Bust. And we covered a whole range of things, from the stock market to commodities to a whole host of things. The most important thing I would glean from that program is the comments on the bond market, because that will ultimately have the greatest impact across all asset classes as we see heightened risk, heightened potential for either inflation or outright default as it shows up in the price of bonds and correspondingly in interest rates.
Well, David, that's a great idea. We've been going back and listening to some of the programs from 2009 as well, and this one you felt was critical that people go back and listen to because of the material that was into it. So let's just go back to May 2009, the big bond bust.
But I think there's some things that we want to cover, Kevin, that I think will add some insight into what the tail end of a bear market will look like and some of the telltale things that have to have occurred, not only in the stock market, but in the bond market as well. So we're going to spend a lot of time today talking about bonds, talking about interest rates, and talking about the pension and insurance company disaster, which is right on the horizon.
Well, and speaking of the bond market, we should probably put things into perspective right now that the bond market is gigantic compared to the minuscule stock market. We think of the stock market as everything, but in reality, isn't the bond market many, many times larger than the U.S. stock market?
5 to 10 times. And if you're looking at the global bond market, you can also say 5 to 10 times the global equity markets. Mm. And we've actually seen a continuation of almost a 30-year bull market in the bond market.
Which means interest rates have been falling.
Interest rates have been falling. The price of bonds have been going up. Anyone who's invested in bonds has done tremendously well over the last 30 years. If you were 100% in bonds, you know, accepting subprime garbage and some things like that, but if you were in sovereign paper, up to this point, you've fared very, very well. And I think up to this point is the critical qualifier. So I want to start with a couple of things, because there are side lights and some things that need to be discussed before we get into the interest rate, bond, and pension fund discussion. But first, I want to start with just a few things that I think we should remember. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac continue to be in the news, and this time Freddie is in the crosshairs. It looks like they're not going to get away with their latest gratuitous lies, and it looks like they will be looked at again, this time under a microscope in terms of their accounting. They have basically accounted for losses on a delayed basis. Now that's coming home to roost.
You know, it seems hypocritical, though, that you've got the FBI looking at Freddie for delaying or not giving complete losses, because in reality, isn't the government actually encouraging banks, mortgage companies, to follow the mark to fantasy model as far as they're told not to actually talk about the real losses or the real values of their assets as well? Isn't
right.
that right?
Well, banks have the free pass from the FASB. What you're talking about is the mark-to-market rules. You know, what they're doing right now, Kevin, is the FASB waived the 157 rule, the 157E, and basically the banks are now hitting the market for as much capital as possible. Everyone is issuing new shares. Goldman Sachs is issuing new shares. You'll see everyone from Citigroup, JP Morgan, Bank of America, they will all go to the market and issue new shares, and we'll get into why that is in just a minute.
Or are they trying to raise capital? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, exactly.
Just before
no.
this thing comes to a head?
Yeah, no, absolutely. They're raising new capital in an environment where everyone's spirits are buoyed, the Dow is on the move, right. and they realize they've got a very short window where they can come to the market and say, hey, listen, happy days are here again. We've gotten our books uncooked, and now we're ready to move forward into a new era of truth and transparency. But I think really what you're seeing, Kevin, is them raising a tremendous amount of money. They are pre-funding. They're lining up liquidity for the next round of write-downs and losses, specifically the mortgage-backed security market. We're talking more about the commercial market, commercial mortgage-backed securities. You know, if you look at the Fed's latest beige book, it shows that commercial real estate's falling off a cliff. And that's just here in the last 6 weeks. But commercial real estate is falling off a cliff in part because you've got $250 billion in commercial paper coming due this year, 2009.
That's a new $250 billion that they're going to have to somehow find a way to get funding for.
To refinance.
Yeah.
If that wasn't bad enough, for 2010, you've got $566 billion in commercial paper that's coming due. They know they're going to have a bear of a time getting this financed, and they know they've got to get their ducks in a row in terms of getting money in the bank, cash on deposit, so that they can hopefully survive this next downtrend in, I think, bank stocks and in the stock market in
general.
Well,
David, you've been trying to put the warning flag out now for the last 6 months saying, yes, the private real estate market is a huge problem. In fact, I just heard this morning that there are 4 million homes nationwide that are empty right now. So this being the bottom of a real estate market or being a buyer's market is sort of a hoax. But in reality, the commercial real estate market, which hadn't shown up right away, that's the thing that you've been warning people, saying that's the next wave to hit.
Yeah, and I think, frankly, this is just a small speed bump on our way to the pension debacle. If you want to talk about a rewriting of the Constitution here in the United States, if you want to talk about populist politics writ large, if you want to talk about outright socialism leading to Marxism, if you want to talk about things that make my hair stand on end and make me want to go outside and throw up in the parking lot, mm-hmm. what happens on the other side of the pension debacle makes the commercial real estate market hiccup look like nothing more than a speed bump.
Well, isn't the pension fund problem actually accelerated because we have so much in the way of real estate mortgages and those types of assets in those pension funds and annuities?
We'll get to that in a minute. I think we ought to recognize the euphemism of the week. It's a fantastic new thing that has come about only in the context of the FASB changing those accounting standards.
Are you talking about economic fair value?
What does that mean, economic fair value?
That's the new word.
This is like having a six-year-old come in and declare very boldly that his bicycle is now worth $1.5 billion. And you grin and you say something like, well, isn't that nice, Johnny?
Yeah.
Imagine that. I only paid $100 for it, and now it's worth $1.5 billion.
Yeah, but what if Johnny's 40 or 45 years old and saying the same thing?
Well, exactly. We wouldn't be humoring ourselves. This wouldn't be a joke. This would, in fact, be believable, and he would be running one of the most powerful banks in the world, practicing the FASB 157E mark to make believe in basically deciding what his assets are worth.
So as long as they're encouraged to lie, like you're talking about, or at least believe their own lie, this market's not going to be able to actually come in and take advantage of these lower prices because they don't actually reflect the risk or the reward in the market at this point, right?
I would agree with that. Now, as a continued theme from last week and for the last several months, we keep on mentioning this word monetization.
Mm-hmm.
Monetization was critical in the 1970s in the ramp up towards inflation because what you do in a heartbeat is create, in that case, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. Today, it's billions of dollars with the stroke of a key on your keyboard.
It's the sound, money being made out of thin air.
Made out of thin air. Now, presently, it's a tool for interest rate manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't what it was in the 1970s, which was a substitute financing mechanism, where there wasn't anyone in the market to buy the bonds, and so you had to, in mass, do that. They're finding that to a small degree, but to a very small degree. There's only scraps in these Fed auctions, or the Treasury auctions, rather, that aren't being picked up by the market. And so the Fed is coming in and purchasing those.
But the free market wants higher interest rates than what actually is being offered. Isn't that where the monetization comes in?
Right. And this is exactly like the 1942 to 1951 period, Kevin. Between 1942 and 1951, the Fed deliberately pushed down interest rates. Now, what would the advantage be of pushing down interest rates in this environment? Well, if you look at this week's monetization, we could probably start our weekly monetization report and just let you know how much of the treasuries offered to the market were not purchased, or how much treasuries from the open market came back to roost
and were purchased by the taxpayer,
and
basically
were forced to be purchased. That's the growing theme. But presently, we saw 10-year treasury yields being manipulated lower. This week, $8.5 billion was monetized. Most of that 7-year and about a billion of it 10-year notes. The significant thing about that, Kevin, you might ask why. Why the 7s and the 10s? 10-year treasuries particularly influence mortgage rates. So if you wanted to suppress mortgage rates, if you wanted to stimulate buying coming into a great buying season in real estate, what would you do? You would artificially lower those rates.
David, you postulated 2 months ago that one of the ways that the Obama administration would try to revive the economy would to make mortgage rates, have them come down below, far below what real market risk in the mortgage market would yield as far as interest. Is this one of the ways of doing it, coming in and monetizing 7-year and 10-year bonds?
It is, Kevin, and I think what we're seeing is we've already got 30-year fixed rate mortgages below 5%. I think last I checked was about 4.85%. If we can get that to 4.5%, I think real world inflation is 6 to 8 to 10% presently. That would be a conservative estimate, in my opinion. So you've already got negative yields. I don't understand why banks would be lending. With inflation being what it is, this is a negative rate. They're not making money on these loans in terms of a real rate of return. But there's other things going on. Monetization is a theme that our listeners have to wrap their minds around. It is something that will accelerate us from a deflationary stretch into superinflation overnight. And when it clicks up from an $8.5 billion to a $10 to a $15 to a $20 to a $30 to a $50 to a $100 billion monetization, you're going to see the wheels come off in terms of inflation.
It's almost guaranteed. It's like eating a pound of butter a day and thinking, well, maybe I'm not going to get fat. No. You're going to get fat. Inflation always comes out of monetization, does it not?
Well, speaking of getting fat, I agree with that, Kevin. But speaking of getting fat, you've got the whole market assuming that now there is just free handouts in the marketplace. If you want to put hard-earned cash into the market, this is the best time to be buying stocks probably for the next 20 to 30 years. And I just have to remind people that insider selling, and we'll talk about what that is exactly, but insider selling is exploding. In the midst of this little run-up, this little run from the 6,000 to the 8,000, if you're feeling smart, recognize yourself as the patsy, the absolute idiot patsy who's stepping into the marketplace to have their head handed to them on a silver platter.
Okay, let me paint a picture then. I'm a CEO. Let's pretend like I'm a CEO. And my pension fund and my account right now, my 401k, has company stock, the company that I actually run. What you're saying, this insider selling, it's the corporate CEOs and the people who are the insiders that have to report those sales. They're coming into the market, and it's how much more selling versus buying?
CEOs, CFOs, CIOs, COOs.
Anybody in the know.
Everybody in the know, including those on the board, are selling at an 8 times multiple.
Wow.
They're selling 800% more than they're buying of their own shares. Well, I think what they see is a drop in profits.
Yeah.
And you can see that in Microsoft. You can see that in General Electric. You can see that in some of the powerhouses who are disappointing in terms of profits.
But then you have the patsies who watch CNBC on a daily basis and they go, gosh, look at all the green numbers. I don't want to miss the bottom.
I don't want to miss the bottom. And so, yeah, we're looking at upbeat presentations from the CEOs and CFOs, which are drawing in the general public to buy shares, and the CEOs and CFOs who have finished their whitewash number crunching for the quarter are actually distributing their own stock, selling their own personal shares in the company.
Right.
And abandoning ship. This is not what captains should be doing, but they're abandoning ship.
They're moving to cash in out of the very company that they run and own.
So just as a reflection back in time, I think it's important to remember that the Nikkei, the Japanese stock market, in its deflationary bear market in the 1990s, saw no less than 7 rallies, which carried 20-24% on the upside, and no less than 4 rallies, which went 40%. They put 40% back in the coffers of the investment public, back in the pockets of Joe and Susie Lunchbox, who were buying Japanese stocks.
Okay, but with those rallies in perspective, how much was totally lost if a person just held on or stayed in that stock market?
Every one of those 11 rallies ground lower, ultimately, to over an 80% loss.
Okay, so that's the answer. I mean, basically, you lose most of your portfolio enjoying these rallies, like what we're seeing right now.
Kevin, it's a lot like going to Vegas and winning a hand of cards. You've lost 2 or 3, you win one, and you get this instinct, this inclination, I'm going to make it back.
Right.
I think I just started a new role. We're on a roll. The next day, the Dow's up 100 points. We are on a roll. The next day, the Dow's up 200 points. My goodness, things have never been better. And what's unfortunate is that they don't have the larger context in view. I think that's important. So on a technical basis, I think it's worth just looking at where the market is technically, both the stock market and the gold market. And then I do want to transition and talk some about interest rates and the bond market, because I think that's where the next serious down leg is going to be focused on.
You're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com.
I want to talk a little bit about bonds, because bonds are a much bigger market than the stock market.
Right.
They impact governments. They impact pension funds. They impact huge, huge stocks of capital, even more so than the stock market. And just from that standpoint alone, it's worth having an understanding of where the bond market is and where we think it's going.
Well, just with perspective, the bond market itself is representative of how much risk is in the loaning business, basically, or in the borrowing business. And if left to itself, the bond market, isn't it a very accurate indicator of risk if it's not manipulated or government subsidized?
Sure. Yeah, it tells you how much risk is in the marketplace, because it's the premium that you have to pay to get a hold of somebody else's money.
Right.
So if you're going to give me $100 on loan, you've got to decide how much of a risk I am. If there's that much risk in the marketplace, not only am I a potential risk in terms of being able to pay it back, but how much risk is there in the marketplace? How much risk is there for the potential of a volatile up move in interest rates? You, as the lender, have to be aware of those things. And so you set the price, or the market sets the price, and you decide if you want to lend on that basis.
But doesn't it seem ironic right now that we're in an environment that most people would say is probably the worst of the century, or at least since the Great Depression, yet interest rates or the risk of loaning money is extraordinarily low as far as the bond interest rates are paying?
And the biggest factor in that, Kevin, is that you have a concerted effort by central banks all over the world,
mm-hmm.
who are goosing the system with as cheap of money as they can make. And they're doing that through two mechanisms. One, quantitative easing, in other words, printing press money. And two, giving people access to cheap money on a loan basis. Mm-hmm. So you do have incredibly low interest rates, artificially suppressed by what we've been talking about, the monetization of debt, where they're coming into the market and buying excess debt and forcing the interest rates even lower.
Well, how long can they do that?
The key thing, Kevin, here is, I think, the background to the bond market. It wouldn't matter if we were at the beginning of a bull market in bonds. It's my contention that we're the end of a 28 to 30 year bull market in bonds.
Hmm.
Interest rates have been coming down for nearly 30 years. And as interest rates come down, the cash value of those bonds continues to rise. And the opposite begins to occur. As interest rates move up, the cash value of those bonds comes down, and you have actually capital losses instead of capital gains.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I think some perspective is helpful. The 200-year chart of interest rates, which I've harped on for 3 or 4 years now, going back to 2003, the 200-year chart of interest rates maps out an average duration of either bond bull or bond bear markets of 22 to 25 years.
And we're well beyond the end of that cycle. We're
pressing 28 to 30 years,
yeah,
in terms of the duration of what was probably one of the greatest bond bull markets ever.
Because the central banks and the governments have extended this artificially.
Yeah, and now you have the government, through monetization, propping it up,
mm-hmm.
propping up the tail end of this bull market. Now, I think what you see in terms of the trajectory of the bond market moving forward is catastrophic for several reasons. One, inflation is death to the bond market, and inflation is being packed into the system. We've talked about that and will continue to, but inflation will kill the bond market.
It hasn't shown up yet, but when it does, it's like a wall of water.
Yep, and as if that wasn't enough, risk premium being properly assessed and being imputed into the bond market will force interest rates up, as people expect greater compensation for greater risk that they're now acknowledging in the market. So those two things, I think, put a lot of pressure on the cash value of bonds. Now, here's where I think things get particularly nasty. We have a time bomb in the public pension market.
Hmm.
If you're looking at CalPERS, if you're looking at the Texas Teachers Pension Fund, you look at every state fund, municipal fund, teachers fund, transportation authority fund, and you're looking at some very interesting things, Kevin. First of all, 40% of them are not adequately funded to begin with.
That was before the crisis.
Correct.
Yeah.
So you're looking at about $2 trillion, which is currently in the coffers. If you go from coast to coast,
mm-hmm.
and you count up everything that is in these pension funds, you've got about $2 trillion in actual capital sitting there. Now, they need $2.9 trillion to be fully funded. So they've got to increase by about 50% or $1 trillion to play catch up, to just make sure everything is fully funded. There's some problems, though, Kevin. And the problems are, you've got anywhere from 30 to 60% of their investment portfolios in long bonds.
Hmm.
You get to the end of a bond bull market, and right. you see capitulation in that market. And what happens?
Yeah.
You begin to see not only an underfunding problem that is a $1 trillion problem today, that gets turned into a $2 trillion problem. It gets to the point where something very nasty occurs. You understand that all they have to do to replace and fully fund these pensions is just go to the taxpayer. Right. And I'm not talking about at the federal level, but even at the state level. The state legislature can say, okay, we are allocating, we're increasing taxes to increase our allocation to the state pension fund. They can't go broke. They can't go broke. If they go broke, you're looking at the largest working population today, state employees, federal employees. If you want to see mass revolt, it's the federal and state employees who say, I'm getting screwed.
Well, many of those people had actually put in positions for 20, 25 years that they didn't really care for that one thing, for that pension.
This is my safety net.
Yeah.
This is how I retire. This is everything in terms of what I consider my future, my golden years.
So with that being threatened, you would have mass outcry for some sort of solution.
Right.
And the only solution you're saying is taxes.
I think that the higher taxes are inevitable, both at the state level, local level, a federal level. That's a given, and a part of it is this funding issue for pensions. If this wasn't bad enough, Kevin, we also have exposure to real estate in these pension portfolios. Anywhere from 5 to 15% of pension portfolios are in real estate. So you've got the 30 to 60% mix, which is long bonds.
Which get crushed if interest rates rise.
Correct. And then you have the 5 to 15% in real estate.
Which gets crushed
if interest rates rise.
Yeah.
And so you've got the boat loaded on one side, and now you're getting just a little bit of a tip from a wave, and unfortunately that means capsize.
Yeah.
That does mean the boat capsizes.
So I guess they could also monetize. The states can't monetize, but the federal government could print the money and just, it seems like it all compounds on top of each other, though. They print the money. You've got inflation. Interest rates have to rise to keep up with inflation. Well, to a degree.
Right. Here's a piece of the puzzle that we keep on talking about, but it is very relevant to this pension scheme. Most of your pension fund managers are after hitting a certain bogey. They have a hurdle that they need to hit. They're expecting 7.5 to 8% returns. These are their return assumptions. And on this basis, they're either adequately funded or underfunded. The problem is that their average rates of return over the last decade, instead of being at their hurdle of 7.5 to 8%, Kevin, have been 2.6 to 3.5%.
So it's heavily loaded, artificially low.
Well, they're not making the money that they need to meet these funding projections.
I see.
Okay, so, but they continue to speculate on the basis of we need this 7.5 to 8% return. Well, we haven't even mentioned the healthcare side of this. Because if we've got $1 trillion lacking in the pension funds just on the basis of retirement needs, then you have the underfunded healthcare benefits as well. And they estimate those on the conservative side to be $600 billion. The high side estimate is $1.6 trillion. So in reality, Kevin, you're talking about a $1.5 to $2.2 trillion underfunding at the state, municipal, and federal level in these pension funds. I'm overwhelmed because so many of these pieces fit together in this puzzle, and unfortunately, it's a very ugly puzzle. It's
just
like a Friday the 13th type puzzle.
Well, it's horrible. If I were to say, do you want to hear the good news or the bad news first, I don't have any good news.
No,
right
the
now.
Bad news is that as the dollar begins to get crushed over the next 18 to 24 months, it compounds all of these problems.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that these pension fund managers, as they're estimating their 7.5 to 8% returns, as they're shooting for the moon in terms of positive rates of return, because we're in a low-risk environment and have been for 25 years, they don't anticipate the ravages of deflation or the ravages of inflation. They're kind of in this middle band of, we might have some inflation and we might have some deflation, but we would never expect these outlying events. We would never expect these Six Sigma events where all of a sudden we've lost a third of our portfolio,
wow,
50% of our portfolio, 70% of our portfolio. Some of those things they're getting wise to with a 27% loss last year on average in these pension funds. They're getting wise to market volatility. So now they understand that the market doesn't always do you favors, okay? The problem is they're not looking at some of the other factors, mainly the end of a run in interest rates and the end of a run in bonds in terms of a bull market. And they're not looking at the end of the U.S. dollar as being the world's reserve currency. And we're seeing that vote right now. Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winning economist, has said, listen, the rest of the world is wising up. The rest of the world knows that it's just a question of how you unwind the current relationship. And that current relationship he's talking about is every central banker around the world saying, we want some distance. We want not so much of a connection to the U.S. dollar as our reserve currency. The implications of that for our pension fund is immense. again, why does that matter to me? It matters to me because I'm an American. It matters to me because I live here. I'm raising my family here. It matters to me because I see politics going from bad to worse. I see populist politics and the largest working bloc in America, who happens to think, by and large, like socialists, I see them going to the voting polls, and I see them changing the Constitution in their favor. I see them voting themselves largesse. I see themselves voting back into place a retirement which has just been squandered by pension fund managers on the basis of heightened expectations in returns, low expectations in terms of risk. I see the average red-blooded American paying the price, and I don't like it. I really don't like it.
Well, once again, Dave, that was a replay of the May 2009 program, The Big Bond Bust. Is there anything, now that we're coming to the end of 2009, moving into 2010, that you'd like to say in recap after listening to that program?
Yeah, Kevin, I think there's several things. One, the stock market has remained robust with a tremendous amount of speculative capital coming back in. Meanwhile, your institutional interests have been on the sidelines. And I think a part of that is, again, if you look at Elliott Wave, you can have a 35 to 65% recovery in the context of a larger bear market.
Just like Japan back when they were having their recoveries. Didn't they have four 40% recoveries on the way to losing most of the entire principal?
That's exactly right. So the larger context needs to be kept in mind. Oil and gas have had a bounce, certainly nowhere near their highs of 15 for natural gas, currently 5, and 75 for oil, with its highs of 147. What we look at this next year, Kevin, is a continuation of the problem. We partially solved the commercial mortgage-backed security problem by the government stepping in and bailing them out.
Monetization.
Well, there's monetization. There's also just money available for refinancing up to a certain amount. And the question is, will that get turned over? Will that get extended, if you will, in 2010? Certainly, as we discuss the pension market debacle, you do have the commercial real estate holdings, which are an issue, and certainly the treasury bonds, which an issue. What we see, Kevin, is this next year, significant trends, significant transitions. The bond market is absolutely front and center. I think that'll be one of the key themes for 2010 is government debt on all levels, not just in the United States, but throughout the globe, where we see pressure build as we now deal with the ramifications of the bailout money. And how do we fund the debt which has been created? How do we make payments on that debt? And as we continue to compound, you've got payments on the national debt, which will soon exceed $500 billion just in interest payments alone. This is compounding the wrong direction for us. Well, how do we get our arms around this? We don't have the statesmanlike conduct of 1921 when we cut the federal budget in half. You remember the context of a market collapse in 1920. 1921 rolls around, guess what? The government says, we can't afford it. Great, we'll cut our expenses. We don't need the Federal Reserve to step in. We don't need liquidity infusions. We don't need to increase our debt loads. In fact, we're going to do the responsible thing like any American would do. If you can't afford it, make it go away.
They took the punch like a man and recovered very, very quickly.
By 1922, the recovery was already in effect.
Whereas 1929 lasted, we wouldn't take the punch like a man. And so we basically, 16 years from 1929, 31, all the way to the mid-40s, that depression lasted.
As a long-term investor, invested from the 1920s through that period, you would have recovered all of your capital by 1953. But I think the bond market is where we're going to continue to focus for some time this year as an indication of stress in the political arena, because we now are up against both a political and geopolitical crisis.
Well, David, when you're doing a show, it's always a risk to go back and listen 5 or 6 months before to see, you know, how the predictions were. Were the trends right? Were you accurate on the numbers? But, you know, in this particular case, the overall subject matter needs to be discussed, even if the numbers aren't matched exactly. I mean, were the trends correct on some of the things that we just heard on this replay of the show?
Yeah, and some of the numbers are worth talking about. Thought the market would top out about 9,500 on the Dow, and it's at 10,500.
Yeah.
Now, granted, we have mutual fund cash, which is historically low. We don't like that. We think we'll see numerous stock downgrades in 2010. We think that analysts and economists are way over-involved and committed to the bullish scenario. We see geopolitical problems in the Middle East. There's a whole host of things that we say, okay, well, I still wouldn't buy it. And in fact, if you go back to our interviews with Russell Napier and look at Q ratios and a rolling average, 10-year average of price earnings earnings multiples were about 40 to 50% overvalued. Mm-hmm. So we were less overvalued 3 months ago. We're more overvalued today. The case is even stronger that this is not the market you buy into for long-term capital gains. This has been 6 to 9 months of glorious short-term speculative gains. If you're a trader, this was the market you wanted to buy. If you're a long-term investor, certainly not. Because you look at indications, like we did in May, of insider selling. And at the time, we were astounded that insider selling was 8 times liquidations of insiders to their purchases.
Well, didn't it go up from there? I mean, these are corporate insiders.
It went up from 8 to 30. It went up from 8 to 30 and still continues at a breakneck speed. So we have, I think, the themes in place. The bond market is certainly one of them. Being cautious, ultra cautious coming into January in the stock market, I think, is well worth keeping in mind. In virtually every market, this is now a time that is ultimately treacherous. Ultimately treacherous because you do have the potential for extreme deleveraging. The amount of debt that is on the world's balance sheets, whether it's sovereigns, corporates, individuals, you're looking at the potential for utter deleveraging and liquidation of debt, which does put pressure on asset prices. On the other hand, we already have inflation in the system in the form of liquidity created, not making its way through the lending system to be multiplied. When it hits that multiplier effect, boom, just as John Williams has said in recent reports, we could find ourselves 2010 hyperinflation. I don't know that I agree with that, but it's worth considering. At this point, the debate continues to rage between deflation and inflation, and the voices and the arguments have gotten stronger and clearer as the year has gone on. It could be either extreme, and frankly, Kevin, it argues even more strongly for the kinds of allocations that we've had and encouraged our investors to have for decades. If you go back to the perspective triangle, we suggest you have a third in cash, a third in gold, and a third in whatever makes sense to you, whether it's income or growth-oriented investments. But having those three balanced, you need to be cautious, because 2010 promises to be challenging, not only from an economic and a financial standpoint and the potential negative feedback loops in those arenas, but also the unintended consequences of policy decisions in the arena of politics and geopolitics. Just to illustrate before we go, Kevin, is this notion of taxing trades. You realize that 60 to 80% of daily volume on the New York Stock Exchange comes from high-frequency traders. And it's in front of Congress right now to add a surtax to every transaction that occurs. If you want to see Wall Street as a ghost town, if you want to see liquidity drained out of Wall Street and pressed into foreign markets and away from the Amex, the New York Stock Exchange, et cetera, watch that piece of legislation get passed. It is death to the markets. And again, what is the negative feedback loop from political decisions into the financial realm, from the financial realm back into the economy? There's a perfect case in point. That's why 2010, we're going to be talking a lot about politics and geopolitics.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or always feel free to call 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.